Right, let's begin. Firstly, it's wonderful to be here. The Shabbos has been amazing, and thanks to Leonard in absentia, and we wish him a refuah shleima, and to Stan, to Jackie for hosting me, and for all the organization. It was just a wonderful occasion to spend time learning with so many different people. People that I know from a long time ago, people that I know more recently, and people that I haven't known at all, and it's just been a really very special experience. So thank you for that, and thank you for making the time on a Motzei Shabbos to gather together for still a little bit more. Also, it's my mother's yahrzeit tonight, so we'll dedicate the shiur to her memory, and to her neshama have an aliyah, and that of my father. She had an amazing impact during the years of my father's rabbonus, both in South Africa and in the States. Not only in support of him and in support of us, her children, going to yeshiva. Going to yeshiva in those days wasn't an easy thing. I spoke on Friday night about how things have changed in the world, and we forget what things were like. When my brother was at school in Johannesburg, he was the only boy in Johannesburg that wore a kippah. He was in a Jewish school. There were 1,000 Jewish kids in the school. He was the only boy who covered his hair, who had a kippah. That was what Yiddishkeit was like in Johannesburg at the time. When I went to yeshiva, there were a few of us who were, and my year was like the first year that there was really anybody going to yeshiva. And going to yeshiva meant you went away for at least a year. There was no email. You didn't make phone calls home because that was expensive. You used to write letters. So when a parent sent a child to yeshiva, it's not like it is today. And you send the child off on their own. People didn't go and take their children to yeshiva. Nobody had money for that kind of thing. So your child went off on his own. And she was very courageous in not only allowing us to go, but encouraging us to go, and supportive in that. And of course supportive in my father's work, but quite apart from that, it's really one of the things that is amazing during a shiva period and thereafter is you learn things about your parents that you never knew. Because people come and they tell you stories. And you would think that your parents will have told you the stories, but they don't. I don't know why not. And sometimes I think about it with my own children. Am I telling them enough stories? And I'm sure I'm not. We don't tell our own stories. Certainly not to our own children. We kind of got other things to talk about. We don't sit there. And maybe it's also the pace of life. In the old days, I guess people used to sit around after dinner, and there was no television, and there was no craziness, and so you sat around and you talked. When do the family sit around and talk? And Shabbos has become a social day, which it's not really meant to be. Yom Tov is meant to be social. Shabbos really isn't, but it's the only day we've got, so we socialize on Shabbos. But that means there's no family time. There's no time to just sit with kids and tell stories. we don't tell stories anymore. We read books, and now we go and we buy these books about the Gedolim and all this because we want the stories. But what about the stories of our own families? Do we really know them? And at Shiva time, people come and they tell stories. And I realized then, much more than I had realized before, and certainly subsequently, how much of a direct impact she had had on so many people, how she had influenced so many people, inspired so many people. So she's very much missed, and this learning is in her memory. So, come inside.
Sorry.
So, here we are. Thanks. If you video, it's fine, as long as you send me a copy. So last night we spoke about Nes. Does anybody remember who was there last night? How we defined a nes when we talked about that at the Onek Shabbos last night? What is a nes? A nes is, well, let me take a step back. What is tahara? How did we define tahara? Tahara, purity. We defined tahara. Don't know if I use these exact words, but I will tonight, as the force that unlocks the power of matter. That's what tahara is. Tahara is the force, it's a qualitative force that magnifies and amplifies and unlocks the power of matter. When an object or when matter has tahara, it can produce a great deal more energy than matter that doesn't have tahara. And that's the theme of Hanukkah. That's what Nes is. Nes is when small amounts of matter can have major impact because of their tahara, not because of their quantity. That's what tahara is. And that's what Hanukkah is about. And that, we said, was the intersection between the two themes of Hanukkah. The theme of... thanks. Oh, we've got a whole tzibur over here. The intersection of the two themes of Hanukkah, the theme of the battle with the Greeks, and the theme of the Neir Hanukkah, of the little container of oil that lasted for 8 nights or for 8 days. The common theme is that very little quantity achieved what you normally need large amounts of quantity to achieve. A very small amount of oil and a very small group of people were able to achieve that. How did they do that? That was Nes. But what was the essence of the Nes? What was the vehicle of the Nes? The vehicle of the Nes was Temeim Biyad Tahirim. That was the vehicle of the Nes. The reason we could do it is because we had Tahara on our side. We had purity. We had Tahara. And the oil the same. There was one little crucible of oil which still had the chesemes of the Kohen Gadol. There was Tahara in the Shemen Zayis that was produced. So when you've got matter that has Tahara, that matter is able to produce far more energy and impact than matter that doesn't have Tahara. So we talked then last night about the power of quality over quantity. Tahara is a qualitative force. And quality and quantity are not two different realms. Quality can impact quantity. Quality can generate quantity. We gave the example of a seed. A seed is a tiny little thing, but look what it can produce, provided it's healthy, provided it has at least biological tahara. And if it has more than biological tahara, then it can produce even more. And we talked about how the human condition at the moment of planting can affect the success of a crop. So there's the tahara of the seed, and the act of planting becomes important. The spiritual world can impact the physical world. There's an interface between the two. There's an interface between quality and quantity. There's an interface between the spiritual and the material, between the supernatural and the natural. That's what Nes is. Those are two different systems, and when they intersect, we see Nes. There's a system of the Ribbono Shel Olam. There's a spiritual system that's taking place all the time. There is a method. There's a system happening in the spiritual world. There's a system in the physical world. There's a cause and effect. The physical world operates, and people can study it and understand causality. When the physical world and the spiritual world intersect, and the spiritual world impacts the physical world, we call that a nes. That's what a nes is. At this particular Shabbos, there's also an intersection, because there's the intersection of the Hanukkah theme, which is Nes, Tahara, the power of Tahara to unlock the force of matter. And there's also the Parsha. And the Parsha that always comes out at this time of the year deals with Yosef. And this is the Parsha, as I mentioned, also in one of the other Shirin. This is the Parsha that deals with Hishtadlus and Bitochen. Hishtadlus and Bitochen, human effort and faith, trust. And those are two different forces that have to operate together. And what is, we're going to look at how does Hishtadlus and Bitochen interface, how do they react, and what is the way that we use them both, and what is their function. So the famous Medrash Rashi brings, that I didn't bring a Medrash with me, but Rashi quotes it in part at the beginning of the Parsha, that Yosef was given an extra 2 years. At the end of the last parasha, sorry?
Because it depended on
the Sarah Mashkim. Mipnei she'tola bo Yosef bitchono lezochroi, says Rashi, because Yosef depended on the Sarah Mashkim to remember him, he had to be in prison another two years. And it's a pity that Rashi doesn't quote the Medrash exactly. I don't think there's a Medrash here. No, I don't think we're going to find the Medrash right here.
Right down there.
That's a Tanchuma. No, that's not going to help us. It's okay. What's important, what the Medrash points out, I don't know the exact lashon of the Medrash, but what the Medrash points out in the beginning of the of this week's parsha is the 2 years were because of the two Zochreini. He says to the Sarah Mashkim, Ki im zechatani itcho kasher yitavloch. At the end of the interpretation of the dream, and if you will remember me when you, it's good for you, Vasiso noim odi chosid, and do with me a chesed, vehizkartani el paro, and he says again, and mention me to paro, vehoitzesani min abayis hazeh, and take me out of this place where I am. So it's clear from the Medrash, the 2 years are 1 year each for the zechatani, because he said you should remember me twice. So what would happen, or, and if he had only said, if remember me once, then what would have happened? Would he then have got 1 year? Was it wrong for him to do it all together, or was the problem in saying it twice? And it seems from the Medrash the problem was saying it twice. Had he said it once, he wouldn't have even got 1 year. He would have got out straight away. So that the once, we've got to try and understand, what did he do wrong? What was so wrong? He's there, you know, the helicopter story, the person says, save me, save me, save me. Hashem sends the helicopter and he's waiting for Hashem to save you. Hashem sends the Sarah Mashkim. What more can you want? That's what he's been davening for all the time. Give me a way out. All of a sudden, he sees there's a way out. It would be absurd not to say something to him. That would be completely absurd to expect him not to say something to the Sarah Mashkim. Who wouldn't? Why wouldn't you? It would be a complete lack of ishtadlus. So it seems that, yes, he should have said something to him, but not quite as much. So he said one extra bihis katani, so he should get 1 year for that. Why does he get 2 years? One, to say it once is not, that isn't the problem. So we're going to understand exactly what it was that Yosef did. And to do that, we need to also understand... And I mentioned this morning when we learned, is Yosef's method of dream interpreting. You see over and over again, you see with Yosef's dream interpreting that he not only interprets the dream, but he gives advice. He acts like a consultant. He tells the Sarah Mashkim what to do, and he tells Paro exactly what to do. He lays out a 14-year economic plan for Paro. That wasn't part of the dream. So what we talked about earlier was the reason he does that is because when Yosef interprets a dream, just as when we interpret an event, part of the thing to interpret is why. Why this dream? Not just what does the dream mean, but why was Paro given this dream? And why was I called in to interpret this dream? So if you work on that, why was Paro given the dream? Paro was given the dream so as to prepare for the Shnos HaRav, so to be prepared for the years of famine. And the same with the Sarah HaMashkim. So if Yosef says to himself, so why is this man having this dream? He's going to get out of jail. He doesn't have to prepare for that. Why? What is he being given the dream? Why is he being given advance notice by the Ribono Shel Olam? You're going to get out of jail, fine. So tomorrow the guard will come and say, you're out. What's the dream for? So Yosef realizes the dream is for me, not for him. The dream is so that I see there's an opportunity to get out. So in saying the Vihiz Kartani and remember me, that's normal. There's nothing wrong with that. It's the second time that he gets into trouble. And to understand that, and to understand this whole approach to Bitochen and Ishtadlus, I want to talk to you about an idea that I use a lot in the business consulting too, and it completely liberates a different way of thinking about life, about everything. And that is to separate between what I call the levers of life and the outcomes of life. And to understand that we operate levers, we don't operate outcomes. So for example, if a pilot is flying a plane and the altimeter starts spinning down, 30,000 feet, 29, 28, 27, 26, 25, he's got a problem. The way we often operate in life is we say, got a problem. The altimeter's going crazy. So let's get busy with the altimeter. Let's fix the altimeter. But what does the pilot do? The altimeter's going crazy. Okay, what does that mean? That means the plane is losing altitude. I can't go out and lift the plane up. What can I do? I can only use the levers that I can control. I can control the thrust. I can control the angle. Let me move the levers that I can control. The result will be the plane will pick up speed and will gain altitude. So when we're flying a plane or we're driving a car, we understand this. We operate the levers and the outcome results. We don't try and operate the outcome. But in life, we don't work that way. We forget about that. We try and operate and control outcome. And that idea is going to be very important in Ishtadlus and Bitochen and in understanding this Parsha. So if you look at levers and outcome is, you know what you want at the end. You know what, even better sometimes, you know what's meant to be at the end. And that's the idea of a dream. The dreams are so central to the life of Yosef. The whole thing starts with his dream. And what is a dream? A dream is the outcome. So when Yosef says, there I am, and the sun and the moon are bowing down to me, and 12 stars are bowing down to me, and the sheaves in the field are bowing, that's the outcome. Eventually that's going to be, that's the vision. How are we going to get there? What has to happen in the meantime? That's a different story. But that's the outcome. That's where he's got to go. And what does knowing the outcome do? So now, imagine what it felt like for Yosef. So Yosef has the dream, and a little while afterwards, he's in a pit with no hope of being saved. No hope. He hears the brothers say, should we kill him? We won't kill him. Let's throw him into the pit. He'll die there by himself. He hears that, and he hears them walking off. So at that moment, in Yosef's mind, there's no possibility of being saved. So what does he say about the dream? It was just a dream. It was just a dream. That's all. Is that what he says? Or does he know in his gut that something's going to happen? And then he gets pulled out. It wasn't just a dream. And then he gets sold to the Ishmaelim. It was just a dream. And then he lands up in Mitzrayim, and they must have made him promise that he wouldn't contact his father, otherwise he would have done so. So he's got no chance of ever getting back again. It was just a dream. Then he gets noticed by Potiphar, and he gets elevated in the home. Maybe it wasn't just a dream. Then the Ashes Potiphar, back in jail, it was just a dream. Then the Saramashkim, maybe it wasn't just a dream. Then the Saramashkim forgets about him, it is just a dream. But he's got this dream all the time. He knows the dream can carry him through. What's interesting is Yaakov. What does it say about Yaakov with the dream when he scolds Yosef? Then what does it say about that? V'shaviv shamar et hadavar. He kept it, he guarded it. Now what's also interesting is that when the sons come and tell him Yosef is dead, and they try to comfort him, vayema ein lehitnachem, and he refuses to be comforted. Says Rashi, ein adam mekabel tanchumim al hachai v'savur shemet. One doesn't get comforted for somebody who's still alive, even if you think he's dead. Doesn't work. Comforting doesn't work. Because the gezerah is that the heart starts forgetting people who've passed on. It doesn't. You don't forget people who are still alive. But look what's interesting. The savur shemet. Savur shemet. What did Yaakov think? Yaakov shamar et hadavar. So what does that mean? What did he think when he heard?
The dream was correct.
Yeah, when he heard that Yosef's dead, what did he say? What about the dream? Yeah. So there's a conflict going on in both Yosef and Yaakov. There's a deep belief in a vision, and the facts don't support it. That's the conflict. Isn't that a very similar conflict to the kind of conflict we all have often? So you have a deep-seated belief in something, the facts don't support it. So what do we do under those circumstances? So V'oviv shamir sadova, it's very interesting to notice. Rashi says, "V'sovar shemes alachai." V'sovar shemes. What does the word "sovar" mean? Where does it come from? What is the root of that word? Svara, which means logic tells me he's dead. Tanchumin doesn't work if it's only logic that tells you you're dead. You've got to believe the person's dead. Yaakov doesn't believe it. He knows it. There are sometimes contradictions. There are stirot between what you believe and what you know. The facts say one thing. Your belief says another. Now, in the Western world, we talked about it last night at the Onik Shabbos also, we're trained to think more by, to be informed more by the facts than by beliefs. But the truth is usually in the beliefs. The truth is not in the facts. Facts can be distorted, and facts can be massaged, and facts can be misrepresented. One has to be able to also get in touch with one's belief. What do I believe? And I'm not even talking in terms of emunah. Just believe. What do I believe about this thing? You hear something, but what do you believe? You hear Lashon Hara. So what are we told about Lashon Hara? You're not allowed to believe it. You hear the facts, and all the facts might support it. You're still not allowed to believe it. Believing is something inside you. Believing is intuitive. And you can choose what to believe and what not to believe. So Yaakov believes Yosef's alive, the facts say he's dead. Mm-hmm. So how do you act? Do you act by your belief or do you act by facts?
Well, he would act by his belief.
Well, no, you act by facts. Fact is, you've got to carry on life as if you can't carry on life as if he's alive. He isn't, for all intents and purposes, he isn't alive. But Shomar es Hadavar, deep down, you know that it is. Yaakov has to operate his life as if this dream isn't going to happen. If Yaakov would start functioning, he would start telling everybody, I'm the big guy that everybody comes down to bow down to, not going to go over very well. So you've got to act, you've got to live your life out based on where you are in reality. Your dream is something that you keep to yourself.
You said Yaakov.
Yaakov and Yosef.
Yosef. That's why I said.
Both of them, Yaakov and Yosef, have to operate according to the facts, but v'shomer es hadavar, they've got to be conscious of the fact that my belief is something different from the facts. And that's okay. There's a contradiction between facts and belief. That's okay. It's not so terrible to have a contradiction between facts and belief. That's normal. That's life. And it happens often. When I had a private conversation with Nelson Mandela for the first time, I asked him two questions. I'll tell you the second question later on. The first question I asked him was, did you ever think you would get out? Did you ever think this could happen? He was president already. I said, did you ever think this could happen? And anybody who hasn't seen Robben Island, let me just say, it's the kind of place that it's like the Bor of Yosef. When you're there, you don't think you're ever going to get out. That's not even a possibility. He said, yeah, sure. I said, did you think you would get out or did you think this would happen? He said, no, I knew this would happen. I said, how could you have known that sitting in jail when all of us thought it was impossible? And you knew? Where did you know from? He said, I knew because we were right. And amazing. I had a vision. I knew this was the outcome. Ultimately, this is what would be. How we would get there, I had no idea. But that this is where we would land, I knew because we're right. Emunah. You're right. This is how it'll turn out ultimately. That's like the dream. You know there's an ultimate vision. You can't see your way there. You don't know how it's going to get there, but there's a vision. That's the bitochen piece. Bitochen is about the outcome. Bitochen is not about how you get there. Bitochen is to know the end game and to believe in that end game, to have clarity in that end game and to believe in it. That's bitochen. But the hishtadlus is the levers. That's where you've got to use the hishtadlus. Let's take a slightly deeper dive. We spoke in the later shir, we spoke in the halacha shir about the din that hadlocha oise mitzvah. That the mitzvah of Chanukah, although the mitzvah is to have the lights in the window and people need to see it and there's pisum adenisa, but the mitzvah is dependent on the hadlocha, on the act of lighting. And if you look at all the halachas of Chanukah, they're about how to light. Once you've lit, there are no real more halachas. Yeah, questions of women don't do malacha for the first half hour, the few little things that go around. But the main halachas are about the act of lighting, because that determines the whole mitzvah. The quality of the action determines the mitzvah. So when we talk about a lever, when you talk about that, the outcome is the Chanukah light must be in the window. The outcome is people should see the light all over. The outcome is you've got a Chanukah licht in the right place. That's outcome. But what is the lever? How do you get that to happen? So in the halacha, we talked about that today. Is it okay? Could you have it automatically lit? What happens if somebody lights is not going to go light them for you? There's outcome. They're in the right place. There's 7 candles tonight, sitting in the window. Very nice. Everything's perfect. Olive oil. Just a goy lit it. Or it was lit automatically by a computer. It wasn't lit by somebody who's chayev. No mitzvah. Zero mitzvah. The quality of the outcome is dependent on the quality of the action that created that outcome. So when you begin to understand that, then you start saying, so where does the hishtadlus go? Is the hishtadlus in the quality or the quantity? The hishtadlus is the quality. Quality becomes the lever and quantity is the outcome. That's Chanukah. That's what Chanukah is about. It's the quality of that first light that enabled 8 nights of light afterwards. It's the quality of the Tehorim that was able to conquer the Temeim. So the hishtadlus has to be in the Tahara, not in the physical effort. And that was the second question I asked Nelson Mandela. I said, you know, without being disrespectful, I was a young boy when you went to jail. And I remember it. I remember the conversations around the tables. I remember your picture. I remember the newspaper articles. You were a bit of a violent terrorist, basically. You were a bit of a gangster. In South Africa, we have a word for that. I said, we call it a tsotsi. I said, you were a bit of a tsotsi. So he smiled. I said, but you came out of jail a statesman. What was the transformation? What happened in jail? That doesn't usually happen that way. Usually you go into jail a mensch and you come out a tsotsi. You went in a tsotsi and you come out a world statesman. What did you study in jail? What courses did you go to? Who trained you? So he smiled and he said, it happened on the first day as the door of my cell closed. I did an inventory to figure out, is there anything I have that they can't take away from me? They've taken everything. Do I have anything left that they can't get to? He said, I went through everything. Everything I went through, they could take it, they could take it, they could take it. Until I came to my dignity. And I figured my dignity, they can't take. I can lose it, I can give it to them, but if I don't want to give it away to them, they can't take it. So he saw, I thought that was a nice chiddush. He said, but that wasn't there. That wasn't the real chiddush. The real chiddush was, what is dignity? Dignity is not about how people treat you. Dignity is about how you treat other people. That's dignity. And so I realized that if I treat everybody with dignity, I'm keeping my own dignity. The moment I stop treating people with dignity, I lose my own dignity. So he saw that. I thought, that was really a chiddush. He said, and that's not the chiddush. The chiddush is that has to include my captors. That has to include my jailers. I've got to treat them with dignity too. Because the moment I stop treating them with dignity, I've lost my dignity and they've taken away everything. And that's all I needed to become a statesman. To learn how to treat every human being with dignity. Because that's my own dignity. And that really defined him. That when he said that, I just said, that's you. That's exactly what you're doing. He understood that all he could do in jail, and think of a parallel with Yosef, Lahavdil, but still think of a parallel with Yosef in jail, developing till the point that Ebon Hashem says, now you're ready to come out and be a king. But you needed that time in jail. Why? What does the time in jail do? To start realizing that at the end of the day, the only thing you can really impact is yourself. You can't change any. You can't change anybody else, and you can't change anything else. You can only impact yourself, but you can impact yourself majorly. And if outcome depends on the taharo, then become a person of greater taharo. Be metaher yourself. Be metaher yourself of ego. Be metaher yourself of self-interest. Be metaher yourself of all the things that make us do and say and think things that we shouldn't be doing and saying and thinking. Just be metaher. Get to greater levels of taharo. Because that will impact the outcome more than anything else. So when we think of that, if you think of the hadlaka, you just think of any mitzvah. So the quality of the mitzvah is not an outcome of the mitzvah. We can't control it. And then you think of a mitzvah. This applies to any action. The quality of the action depends on what you put into it. It's like baking a cake. You put the ingredients in, you do the right things, and the rest you kind of hope it comes out. And it comes out. All you can do is control the ingredients and the things you put into the cake. So it is with life. And you look at what is it. There are a couple of elements. You've got to look at what you're doing. If you're lighting Chanukah Licht, what are you doing? Is it the right oil? Is it in the right place? Is it the right numbers of candles for tonight? You've got to look at when you're doing it. Is this the time? Is it already after Shkia? Is it sufficiently after Shkia? Is it too late? So I've got to look at what I'm doing. If you're talking about the quality of an action, because that's what we control. That's the art of living, is the quality of our actions. Every action is qualitative. Every action we do is a piece of quality that we can control. And what do we control with the actions? What we do? Is the what correct? We're doing it all correctly. When are we doing it? Where are we doing it? We learned today that the place also impacts. Are we doing it in the right place? Is it appropriate? Are we in the right place? What? When? Where? What else do we have to cover? Who's doing it? Am I chayev? Am I the right person to be doing it? And who am I at this moment? Do I have the right state of mind? Am I free of ego sufficiently? Am I who I need to be? Because the greater I can become, the greater the mitzvah is. The object and the subject merge in the mitzvah. The greater I become, the greater the mitzvah becomes. And why? Why am I doing it? What are my intentions? What are my kavonas? Those are the things that govern the quality of an action. And that's all you can govern. Then you've got to step back. Once you've done the action and you've made sure that the what is correct, that the when is correct, the where is correct, the who is the best who that can possibly be, the why, your intentions are the best intentions that can possibly be, that's the end of your control. You have no more control of the outcome. At that point, you've got to leave it alone. And there the lights are. And is it going to be Pesumah Nis or not? Who knows? Are people going to pass by and say, huh, Chanukah lit? You don't know. You have no control over that. All you have had control over is that you've done what you need to do. You've fulfilled what you need to fulfill. So if we understand that, let's go back to the parasha itself and see what Yosef did. So now, Vayesaper Saramashkim is Chalom Eli Yosef. The Saramashkim tells the dream to Yosef. Yosef listens. And Yosef says, Zeh Pisroinu, he gives him the solution. And then he says, Ki im zechartani itcho kaasher yitav loch ve'asiso noim odi chosid. The right thing to do is when things are good with you, to remember me. And that will be a chesed. That's all I'm asking. And it's not even me asking. That's part of your dream. Because I've got to ask myself, why did you dream this? And the only reason I can think that you could have dreamt this is so that you remember me when you're in a position of influence. Otherwise, why would you be dreaming it? Why would this even be happening? So clearly, this is what's meant to be. Yosef, stop there. Just stop there. That's all you have to do. What does he do when he says Viskatani or Paro? Now what's he doing?
Now he's trying to.
Now I'm controlling. Now I'm getting into control. Outcome. I'm telling you what to do. Yosef, you're going too far. Vahoitse Sani? And you will take me out Minabai Sazer? Yosef, you've lost it. It's not the Saramashkim. This is all the Ribbono Shel Olam. Of all people, you, Yosef, how can you think that the Saramashkim is going to get you out of jail? That's where he messes up. Vahoitse Sani, to start involving himself with outcome. I don't know whether he's going to get you out of here. I don't know what the result is. All I know is this is hashgacha that it happened, that he told you the dream, that you revealed the outcome, the dream to him, that you planted in his mind. The reason he had that dream was so that he could do a chesed with Yosef. Stop. Will he do the chesed? Won't he do the chesed? What will the chesed look like? What will happen after? We don't know. You've done the right thing. That's the point at which to stop. We also have to know when to stop the hishtadlus. Hishtadlus is not something you don't do. Hishtadlus is you do to a point, and then you stop. That's what hishtadlus is. Hishtadlus is there's no intention that we shouldn't do hishtadlus, unless we're living in Bederech HaNes, there are situations and there are individuals who can live without hishtadlus. But for most of us, no expectation or desire that we should live without hishtadlus. The question with hishtadlus is not whether you do hishtadlus. The question with hishtadlus is, are you pulling levers or are you controlling outcome? Question number one. And number two is when to stop. You've pulled the levers already. It's enough. So what does the captain of the plane do? He sees the altimeter spinning, going into a spin. He adjusts the levers. He gets things right. The speed increases. He increases the thrust. And you see, that's all you can do. After that, you've got to stop panicking. You've got to sit back and now let the plane find its altitude again. Just wait, let it happen. You've got to allow things to happen. You've got to allow it to emerge. And this idea of hishtadlus being identify the levers and be careful that your effort goes into levers, that your effort doesn't go into outcome, because that's very wasteful effort. Trying to control outcome takes a lot of energy and you get little result. Levers, the very word lever, what does lever mean? A little bit of energy and a lot of result. That's what a lever is. That's why it's important. Hishtadlus means identify the levers and push the levers. Don't mess with the outcome. It's too difficult for you. Hashem does the outcome. It's too big for you. You're not going to do it. You need levers. Use the levers. So if you look at that, and let's just look at a few examples. So for example, I'll give you the examples in business for first, because they're easy to picture and understand. Are results, are financial results levers or outcomes? Outcomes. If you serve a customer and you're providing a valuable service to a customer, the result is, and you're doing it efficiently, the result is financial results, profit. That's an outcome. So when a manager in a business is having a conversation, we're not getting the right results, we're not getting the right numbers, we need to get more numbers, we need to do more sales, what's he doing?
He's trying
pushing
to do
outcome, the outcome, trying to push outcome. It's a lot of energy and it's not sustainable. If he sits back a moment and says, so what are the levers of these results? Are we identifying the right customers? Are we giving them a good enough service? Are we focused on them? Or are we focused on the results? If you're focused on the results, the customer feels it. I often give the examples because people can sense it in those situations. Think of a doctor. You go to a physician and you sense all he's interested in is the results, not the results of your blood tests, but the results on his bank account. And you in America, you feel that very, very often. I don't know if you do here. You feel that that's his interest, to get you in and out of his room as fast as possible and do as many procedures as he can on you without getting sued so that he can claim as much as he can from the insurance company and you're just a vehicle to his profits. When you feel that, what does it make you feel? Terrible. You don't want to go back to that doctor. Every business is the same. You can feel when you're just a vehicle to the business's bottom line. And it's not sustainable. Customers don't stay with such a business. So you've got to be able to focus on the lever. The lever is to make the customer feel valued. The outcome is the profit. People talk about culture. People are becoming more and more aware of the power of culture in a business. Is the culture in a business an outcome or a lever? So that's now that becomes an interesting thing. Culture in a business is an outcome of some things and a lever for other things. So it's a lever to attract talent. But it's not a lever in itself because you can't create culture. Culture is an outcome of midas, of leadership behavior. Leadership behavior is the lever. You can control your leadership behavior. You can't control the culture. Culture is an outcome. If you lead with midas, you will have a good culture. If you lead with greed or you lead in an autocratic way and you lead in a bullying way, in an intimidating way, you'll have a bad culture. Culture is an outcome. We talked about raising children last night and the fact that you can't control children anymore. You can't control anything anymore. That was one of the topics. It was a wonderful conversation last night, by the way. Those of you who were there, just open and interesting and great comments and questions and challenges. And one of the things we talked about is we've got to understand the idea of miketz. Miketz means there are periods that end and new periods start. Miketz is different. It doesn't say, there's a difference between sof and ketz. And it says miketz, at the end of a predetermined era. There's a point at which an era is over and you've got to identify new trends. You've got to realize the trends have changed, new trends, there's a new force in the world and you've got to be able to identify that and get on board with that. And the days of control are over. You can't control anything. They can't control their borders. You can't even control your borders anymore. And to try and control your borders is almost futile. You can't control information anymore. You can't control... What can you control? So there's less and less that we can control. And the same is with children. To think that we can control our children, we can't anymore. And the age at which we can no longer control them is getting younger and younger and younger. So now we've got to say, well, their experience is not a lever, it's an outcome. We used to think control was the lever. Or we used to think that their behavior was a lever, and we'll control their behavior. Can't do that anymore. Their behavior is an outcome. The life, their values is an outcome. It's an outcome of the time you spend with them. It's an outcome of the conversations you have with them. It's the outcomes of the Mesirus Nefesh they see you show. What do you show Mesirus Nefesh for? Those are the things that stick with the child, the things they see their parents make sacrifices for. Those are the levers. So if you want to give your child a Jewish education, what's the lever? Not necessary to send them to a Jewish school. That might be one of the levers. The lever is for the child to see that you're Moser Nefesh, for Chinuch. What sacrifices are you making for Chinuch? That's how you give the child a Jewish education. You want your child to daven, to go to daven regularly, to go to minyan regularly. What sacrifices do they see you making together? Those are the levers. We've got to get... The lever is not, kid, get up, it's time for davening. That's control. Now you're trying to control outcome. The kid goes to davening, that's outcome. The lever is, you go to davening. That's the lever. So we've got to start getting better at understanding what are the levers for the outcomes we want and start putting the hishtadlus into the levers and not into the outcomes. So that to me is one of the important limudim in this parsha, the parsha of hishtadlus and bitochen. Was Yosef criticized because he did bitochen? Absolutely not. Clearly the Sarah Mashkim was sent to him so that he would do that little bit of hishtadlus. That the ishtadlus is the lever. The ishtadlus is to inspire the Sarah Mashkim to be a kiddush Hashem for the Sarah Mashkim. And that's it. Then you've got to be willing to let go and to trust that you've done your bit. The hadlaka is a mitzvah. You've done the thing right. Written with the right oil. You've put it in the right place. You lit it the right time. And you did it with being the best person you could be. You prepared yourself for the mitzvah before. You thought about it before, you learned the halachas before, you focused your mind on it, you had the right intention. You were the best you could possibly be. So the quality of the action is pure. The more tahara they can be in the quality of the action, the more powerful is the outcome. And Yosef's quality of action was great until the second vizkatani. And then he reveals that he's trying to control. Yosef, you're not yet ready to come out. You're trying to control your brothers. You were trying to control your father's opinion of your brothers. You've been a control freak all your life. It's time to lose control. That's what jail's for. When you have no control. Oh, so finally we've got to the point now that Rebbe Hashem says, you've learned how to give up control. Time for the Sarah Mashkim to come and get you out of here. No, back again. Now you've got to control the Sarah Mashkim. Until Yosef gets to the point where he understands there's no more control. And now he's ready to take a role of leadership. Isn't that interesting? You can become a leader when you've learned how to give up control. You can become a leader when you've learned how to invest in the quality and the tahara of a maise, how you speak to another person, how you come across, how you project yourself to another person, how present you are when you're with another person, what energy you're putting out, how inspirational you are. Those are the things, not the control abilities. And that's the
time. Pharaoh, when you told Pharaoh what to do?
No, there he's just interpreting the dream.
So no, when he told him, you should appoint somebody.
That's all part of the interpretation of the dream. So when he says, why was Hashem giving this dream to Paro? Why is Paro being given advance notice? Because you've got to make preparations. What are the preparations? And he goes through the logical process of what would be the right process of preparation. So over there,
he doesn't say
make me, and he's not instructing. He's just giving it. He's just telling him, giving him advice. There's no instruction. This is the advice. This is what you should do. And that's all part of the dream. That's why you're dreaming this parrot. So in my role as interpreter, I've got to not only tell you what you dreamt and what it means, I've also got to tell you why you dreamt it. You dreamt it so that you can prepare, and this is the best way to prepare. So he takes it all the way, but he, no control. At that point, he rises. So that is it's the key, and it's interesting how the world is coming around to understanding so many deep things in Torah. But they're getting it without Torah. It's just, there's a force in the world today that they're beginning to understand spiritual things. And this is something that is written about, that when you're able to give up control, that's the point at which you have the greatest control. Because that's the point at which you come over and project yourself in the most inspirational way that can possibly be. And that's what it is. Hishtadlus and bitochen. They're two forces, just like quantity and quality. The one impacts the other. Hishtadlus impacts bitochen. And bitochen, more important, bitochen impacts hishtadlus. Because if you've got the vision clear, then you know the vision's going to happen in any case. I'm not going to create the vision. The vision is going to happen in any case. All I can do is make sure that the input, what I put into it, the levers I control, that those things I do in the best way I possibly can, that I understand as I'm sitting in jail, everything's been taken from me, I'm stripped of everything, what have I got left? Just who I am, just the quality of human being I am. That nobody can change. That's the only thing you can really control, is what quality of human being are you, and what is the quality of your interactions. It's the only thing you can control. And that's sometimes the thing we put least effort into trying to control. We want to control everything around us, except the one thing we really can control, and that is our own quality, our own tahara. Tahara samachshava, how purely we think, how purely we interact with people, the purity of our motivations and intentions. Those are things we can control. and the power when we control that, the power that we're able to generate and the impact that we can have not only on people but also on the things around about us is truly massive. So if we can take that away from the intersection of Hanukkah with the Parsha and understand it's Tyro as the quality that unlocks the power of matter, and Bitochen is the vision that unlocks the power of Ishtadlus. Because when you have the Bitochen clear, when you know what the vision is, and you identify the levers and the outcomes, that's an outcome, that's not a lever. And you put your effort into the levers, a little bit of movement of a lever can have an enormous effect, an enormous outcome. And you think of it sometimes, I think of if you're aiming a missile at Mars or wherever, and it's going to go straight. Once you fire the missile, it's going to go straight. And you're off by a thousandth of a millimeter in aim. How many millions of miles are you going to miss it by? It's when you're dealing at source, tiny little improvements, tiny little calibrations and refinements have massive impact. If you're trying to change the world out there, you're going to need a lot of work and get little results. If you change yourself, a little bit of work on ourselves, just a little bit, and the results are magnificent, the results are incredibly impactful. And if we can take that away from Hanukkah and by recalibrating ourselves in our own little ways, each of us, working on the Taras HaMaiseh, that when we do an action, whether it's a Ben Odom L'Chaveiro, or it's a Ben Odom L'Mokum, or it's just our day-to-day activities, as we're able to introduce greater Taharo into the actions, so we're going to get greater results in the outcomes, and create a world in Yitz Hashem that is not only more sane, but has more Kedusha and more capable of delivering the visions that we're all hoping for and all waiting for.